This is an interview with Louis Lajeunesse taking place at his home at 607 West Hampton Street in Marquette. The date is April 9th, 1994, and my name is Mary Tippett Andes. All right, if you can give me your name and your date and place of birth.
I'm Louis Lajeunesse, I got kind of nervous.
Okay, Louis, that's okay.
Yeah. And
when were you born?
I was born in 1914, and my birthday is 23rd of June. Okay. And
where were you born?
I was born in West Branch, Choctaw Township.
In West Branch. What's your middle name, Louis?
It's T, Treple.
Can you spell that for me?
Aye.
No, okay, we'll get that later. Now, were you born at home or were you born in a hospital?
I was born at home, yeah. Yeah, they had those midwives in them days, yeah. And,
all right.
There was lots of that in those days. And
that's fine. Now, can you tell me where you went to school and how long you went to school?
It was in West Branch Township. I went to school, and I went to the 8th grade. That's what they went in the country schools.
Okay. Can you tell me why you only went to school through the 8th grade?
What do you say that?
Can you tell me why you only went to school through the 8th grade?
Because that's as far as they went in the 8th grade, and then we had to work the farms, and we couldn't get to go to high school in town because it was about 20 miles to town from the farming country, and so it was hard for all the kids. There was a lot of kids that just went to the 8th grade, and some of them finished high school after they got married, you know.
Can you tell me what your parents' names are, your mother's maiden name, and then tell me what their nationality was?
My mother's name was, her maiden name was Bina Santamore, and my dad's name was Joel Lajeunesse, and they were French. We were all French, and my parents, they all come from Canada, and years ago, and they come here into Choctaw Township. They moved up here.
Did they ever tell you why they decided to move from Canada, just for my curiosity?
Well, they moved here from Canada because there was a lot of people moving around those days, and lots of people done that, and they figured they had come and started farms and homesteads, and they had to clear so much on those homesteads every year in order to hold their rights on it. It was an acre a year, I think they had, for the farming countries to claim that homestead. And they could get as much as they want. We had almost a couple hundred acres. And that was all hardwood, lots of timber. And so there was a lot of timber to work with. And as it cleared, as we cleared it, we cleared more than an acre because on the end we had about 175-foot acres, a farm, and we used to plant lots for everything, and we had it all. We used to blast all the stumps to make the farm, and all the timber went. We sold the timber, and in the winter time, it all went. Clement Cliff bought most of it, and long stuff, and all the way from 28. That was a year of 1928, we saw Ben Holly Timber, and then what was, you know.
Okay, that's okay. Now you finished eighth grade, and you worked on the farm, and you helped to harvest timber. How long did you do that? Until what age?
I did that. I helped a good 10 years. Me and my older brother, and you want me to tell about the mines?
Sure.
Okay. What? And all the timber, most of the timber went into the mines, and then we had tie cuts that went for Northwestern. And
can you tell me real quick what a tie cut is?
Tie cuts is for 8-foot tie cuts went for railroad ties. And all the bigger timber went for the Cleveland Cliff, and lots of the bigger timber went for long timber up to 19 feet long, went to the Athens mine, and Bunker Hill was smaller stuff, and the moss, we hauled to the moss lots, and then we hauled to different mines up there, and for a good 10 years, and then that went for my dad then carried on from there a good 20 years, I guess, and I spent about 10 years in the woods.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead.
And then I finally got a job in 42 for the Cleveland Cliff. And then I went into I started at Negaunee mine, and then when the Matter A opened up, we were transferred over there. So and then it was putting all steel there. So it was a brand new ball game we had to go into, you know. And so we had to go to school to use acetylene torches and burn all the steel and. One repairing and put all that steel together, you know, and many kinds of steel we worked with, and we had to go to school for that, and it was a great experience. To me, it was.
I want to back up just a little bit, Louis. Would you happen to remember how much, when you were providing the timbers for the mine, how much would you get paid? Was it paid by the foot, or how was that done? And then. Did you cut the timbers to a certain size before you sold the wood to the mine, or did they cut it to the size they needed?
In like the timber days, we used to cut it the size that they wanted. That was 9 feet long, and what they call a switch ties was about 19 feet long, and you used to use some awful heavy timber, like especially the Athens. They wanted all the bigger stuff they could get because it was all hematite, and it was all heavy, and it wouldn't last too long because there was such a pressure on it, and it'd last maybe a couple, 3 weeks of timber like that. You know, it would bust open and crack and so forth.
Now, what's your understanding of why the timber would crack and break in 3 weeks' time?
I think the timber would crack because it was heavy, and I think it seemed to be the heat down there or something. It was the heat and water or something would make it go. And I think it was more heavy. It was pressure on it, and it had to go, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you think maybe it was because the ore was quite soft?
Yeah, I think it was because the ore was quite soft, and hematite was moved all the time, and a good pressure, yeah, all the time. And so when one of those timbers would go, they'd have to replace it.
Do you remember what the, you mentioned the length of each piece, but do you remember what the diameter or what the dimensions would have been around it?
The timber went all the way to 17 inches true, and down well, it wasn't too heavy. From there, from about 16, 17 inches, then down to around 8 inches was the smallest they took. Yeah.
Do you remember what you got paid by the foot for the timbers?
We got so much of timber, regardless of if it was big or if it was down to 8 inches.
Do you know what that amount was for each timber?
Well, it ran about $1.50 a piece those days, yeah. And
let's talk a little bit now about you said you started working at the Negaunee mine, and can you tell me, you said it was maybe 1942, and I'm wondering if you recall what it was like the first couple days that you worked at the mine.
And that's Negaunee mining.
That was where you started first,
right? Yeah.
Yeah.
1942, I started in Negaunee mine, and I got to be a timber heister, and I was listening to all those blasts going, and it kind of shut me up at first, but it took about 6 months before I got used to it, but they put me with other people working, you know, and he says, "Don't get nervous." He says, "It's just a blast." So, and still would shake you up, you know. And then first you know, the motors would be coming in and pretty fast, and you must have traveled 30 miles an hour down there, I believe.
Now, can you tell me a little more specifically what a motor is?
They're all electric motors, and they can't use no gas, not much gas. It's all electric and air. It's operating the mine, and which is there's no gas in it involved at all. And
now the motors were what were used to push the cars and things.
The motors were push the cars, and they must have had. I think they had about maybe 10 cars in the Negaunee mine, but there were different kind of cars than we used in the other mines, and they were smaller.
Can we talk a little bit about the blasting? You said that was a little bit nerve-wracking. Can you tell me what it was? What happened when there was a blast? I guess what was it that kind of shook you up a little bit? Was it noise? Was it a lot of rumbling? Was it a lot of shaking? What was it that was bothersome to you?
And when the blast used to go off, then it was the whole mine shut, rumbling, and it must have been all the way to 20 holes on small drifts, you know. And they were all 8-foot holes, and
I guess what I'm kind of wondering is, let me ask you another question. You had until this time worked outside all the time, harvesting timber and things like that, and then you changed to working underground. Did you have a real strong sense of being aware that you were quite a distance underground? Did it feel a little confining to you?
When I first went down, it was quite a ways down. It was just something like a elevator, you know, in a building, but they call them cages. Mm-hmm. And they went down. They took about 50 men down at the time, and they went so fast that you didn't notice it. You know, you were down there before you knew it, and then you got down there and you went into the places and it was. After you're down there a while, you never noticed it. After you got used to the place and underground, it was just like you didn't notice it from being down there or up. You know, you got used to it, and it was just like another job. You know, and it was interesting. And,
now you said that you had to hoist timber. What was the name of that job that you had?
Well, hoisting timber was supply timber for the off the levels into the contracts, and we were a couple guys, and so we done that for about a year, and then one day the captain, the boss, says, "About time you go mining, though. You know, would you like that?" I said, "No." I said, "Could try it." So I started after a year, and then I went mining ever since, you know. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. You said that you had to hoist the timbers into the contracts. What's a contract?
The contract is where you do your drifting and blasting, and you run long drifts up to 175 feet long, and they're all 28-foot centers. And then they put all their mills in there, and that's where they scrape the dirt down, and then you keep going ahead with the drifts, and then you cone them out.
What's coning?
Coning, they're called mills, every 28-foot centers on both sides, and there's a mill run right across one that are, and then they cone it like a... Just fan it out and drill it out in a cone like a fan out, and then they blast that, and that makes a mill, and then the dirt will come from those mills, and they're right across one another, and they run them about 175 feet deep and 150 whatever, you know, what they surveyed. And then they pull where the ore is. Yeah, then you scrape. You get through with that, and then you scrape the dirt down in the hoppers into the yeah.
Now you said you had been working hoisting timber for about a year, and then you were put into the job of being a miner. Can you describe what you had to do?
Well. When I went mining, that's what we did. Was mostly put drifts in, yeah, and then cone them out, and for the scraper men could scrape dirt
Okay, now you were a miner. Then your job description was miner for about how long?
Well, it was altogether, I had around 36 and a half years, and all but 4 years of that, I didn't go mining. I was transferred to a pellet plant at Eagle Mill, and that's when the mine kind of slacked up there a little bit, and I went on a D9 and worked on the stockpiles and moved the track over for the electric shovel. Okay. And we used to push the railroad cars down up to 18 of them 90 tonners when they were loaded. And we used to push them down to the heights. And that was my job. And then scrape the pellets up to the shovel when they could pick it up and work on the roads and then took care of 2 miles to the carp for the big pumps would be running for the pellet plant in the winter time. It was almost 8 feet of snow there. Mm-hmm. In the 60s. Mm-hmm. Okay. And you had to keep that all open and around the plant with that big dozer. And I stayed there about almost 4 years. And then when the bees started again, hiring miners, so I went back to the bee then and finished off there. in a mining system.
I'd like to get a little bit of, you said that you worked at several different mines. So you were at the Nagani mine first, and then for about how long?
Nagani mine, I must have been there, well, going on 10 years, roughly. And then the Matari was ready to go then. And that's when I was transferred to the Matari.
So you went to the Matari when it first opened?
Yeah. When it first opened.
Okay.
And the Matari when it first opened. And I stayed there till it was all finished, till we got transferred to the B then. Yeah.
Do you remember maybe approximately when the Matari closed?
Gosh.
Or even like how many years did you work at the Matari, I guess would be a better question.
I think the Matari, between the Matari and the Nagani mine, I had 18 years there, between the two.
Okay.
And while I was to the Matari, they asked me if I wanted to put a drift, help going with a gang and put a drift from the Matari over to the B. That was on a, I think, on a 13th level or something, or the 12th level. And that was going on to 15 degrees, and there was a 5-man crew on there, and we drove a good 10-foot holes there, about 60 holes. It was 25 feet wide, and at least 10 feet high, and we drove that almost 3,800 feet, which was lacking 300 feet from 3,800 feet, and that was going down on a 15 degree, and they had a belt going down there that was 36 inches wide, and the steel stands was 2 feet apart and all brand new. The belt was 3/4 inch thick, all one piece belt.
And what was that belt for? Was that for conveying ore?
That belt was for the conveyed ore to the right from down there. They had all the hoppers in. They had all the hoppers in, and there was places with a lot of ore that was hitting. We were running into rock once in a while, but there was a lot of ore down there. And then we had a little car that went down alongside of it. But that was like a little trolley car that was running on the cable, the track on the side, to get down there. And it was, and then they had a big heist up there, an electric heist there. I don't know how many horsepower that was to run that belt. It had to be pretty powerful anyway. And there was a man up there all the time, and there was a dispatcher up there, all that, and we could talk back and forth. And we was in there 5 years putting that drift in, and we used to blast around 60 holes, made a blast a day, and they were all delays, were all timed, and from 1 up to 60, and then our center holes would go first, and then we'd work around it, and it would all go timed, but they were all timed. Yeah,
any idea,
it was interesting.
Any idea how long it took to drill one hole? You said you did one blast a day. That's a lot of preparation time to do one blast, isn't it?
Yeah. We used to drill one blast a day, and it was a lot of drilling. It was a lot of drilling, yeah. But there were powerful machines, and there were all 90s machines on there, it wasn't too bad. You know, they had a lot of power,
mm-hmm.
yeah, running all by air. Yeah.
Now, did you notice when you went from the Nagani mine to the Matari, you said the Matari was a brand new mine. Are there any differences, specific differences that stand out in your mind that made this Matari, the brand new mine, different from the Nagani mine?
Yeah, going to the Matari was a lot different. it was a lot different. It was more modern, and everything was different, that's all. And that's where they started to go to a lot of more safeties, and then we went into the steel, more or less, and then we had to learn to. We went to school, I don't know, a day a week, I guess it was, and for all acetylene equipment and stuff, the oxygen and acetylene. They teach you how to shut it off, and then teach you how to burn and all that stuff, and how to turn them on, get your pressure, and it was. New steel was nice to burn, but when it got rusty a little bit, you had to take a pick and get all the rust off before it would burn good and stuff like that. And so I learned a lot of stuff in that there, and a lot of safeties.
Do you remember any specific safety things that were new at the Mather A at that time?
And they learned a lot of safety things, mostly everything, right? From home, from your lawnmowers, cooking eggs in your frying pan, and don't run sanders or anything. A lot to having glasses on. And I still do that when I work in my shop. And it was, I just carry on that safety all my life, so what they learned me. And I thought it was great because even from the lawnmower, all that stuff, and all the safeties you could think of, they brought them up. And I carry most of them. I watch that pretty close.
That's really good. Can we talk a little bit about the routine that you had every day in the mine? I know you would report for work, and then did you have to punch a time clock? And I understand that the men changed clothes, and did you have lockers to put your clothes in while you were underground? All of that. Can you give me kind of a little run through of what happened from the time you got to work until you went underground?
And when we went to work, we put our clean clothes in our lockers, and then we put our work clothes on, and again, and then we go down. We come back in 8 hours, and 8 hours was collar to collar, and make sure you get you up, and then we take a shower, and then put our clean clothes on again, and then we head for home. Mm-hmm. And then when I first started in the mine, that was in the Ghani mine, more or less. There was all somebody waiting there with a basket of pasties, and that was interesting, and that wasn't hard to take, you know, for 50 cents. So we used to get a pasty for 50 cents, and they'd make sure they'd be there, you know, and the guys would be all buying a pasty, you know. And it was really good after a day's work. Yeah.
So when you bought a pasty, you would eat that after you finished your day's work? Did you eat underground at all?
Underground, we'd have just a few sandwiches, you know, and then a bottle of coffee, you know. And you couldn't carry no glass jugs down there. They bust them all the time. And when you get on the cage, you know, it's pretty packed in there, and they didn't want no glass jugs anyway, because somebody probably cut themselves on them, and so they use plastic jugs more or less, and that's what they use for water, but they took thermoses and dinner pails on there.
And, when you started working at the mine, at any of the mines, did you have to join a union?
We didn't have, well, yeah. like the union come in, I think I was in, there was no union when I started in 42, and it started, I think, in late 43, I think it was, the union got started, and then there was some heavy strikes there to come on after, but everything leveled off pretty good according to times, and then the union got in there, and then the wages started to go up a little bit, and benefits, and which was great, and
all right, Louis, this is the second side of our conversation with Louis Lajeunesse, taped on April 9th, 1994. Let's talk a little bit, Louis, about what you remember your income was during the time you worked at the Nagani mine, and then maybe approximately what it was at the Mather A.
When I worked at the Nagani mine, our wages were run around every 2 weeks was about $45, and we even built a house on it, you know, a two-bedroom home, and lumber wasn't very high. I think it was about $17 a thousand, and 2x4s you'd get them from 60 to 70 cents. And so we'd done quite a bit with our money at that, and we didn't buy no new cars, but...
I think we'll get into the question of building houses and things like that in another part of this interview, but for now we'll go back and backtrack to about when you stopped working at the Mather A and what you did then.
I got a job for, then I went to, when I was laid off, when I was laid off from the Mather A, then I went for Union National Bank, and they had a lot of remodeling, and like doing carpenter work and all that stuff, and painting. So about 90 houses to take care of. So I worked about 6 days a week on that, and then when Eagle Mill, when Eagle Mill started up, I went there. There was opening there, so that's when I went to Eagle Mill then.
Eagle Mill from the
Mather A, yeah. After 3 years, I was laid off, and then I went there and.
You worked at the Mather A for 3 years, or you were laid off for 3 years?
I was laid off for a couple of years. I was laid off for a good couple of years, and then I went to, that's when I got a job in Tallahassee.
Okay. Now, Willie, could you tell me the approximate year that you started at Eagle Mills and how long you worked there, and then where you went after that?
I think it was in 60 that I started in Eagle Mills, and I stayed there almost 4 years. I put that down already, didn't I?
Okay.
About the tractor.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, I did all that. So.
Okay. So then, can you tell me when you started at the Mather B?
When I started at the Mather B, it had to be about 64 or 65, someplace in there. And that's when it started to matter, B. And And it was the same kind of work because I'd done quite a bit at the Mattery, and all steel work and drifting. And we drilled long holes there up to 125 feet. And those were long holes for and slopes and all that.
Can you tell me what a slope is?
It caves in as it keeps coming down, and it keeps working, and it comes down, and it comes down into the mills, and that's where they pull the dirt from, and you drill on the side of the slopes, and then you drill those long holes up to 125 feet, quite a few of them, and with big machines. And then you charge them with 2 foot powder, and they're 2 inches thick, and sometimes you use use primacord on those long holes, in the cap, and one stick of powder, and then you use this. You put all this. I can't think of the name. And you blow in all this pearl stuff in there, and it's awful powerful. It looks quite a bit like that stuff you put on your lawns, and it takes a cap to make it go off, but it's awful more powerful than dynamite. And you put as many holes as you need there to go around, and it brings. When you blast that, it makes tons and tons of dirt comes down, and then it goes into the mills, and then they got to buy a new supply again of ore to pull until that drains dry, and then they do it again if they have to. And them slopes, you never can see how deep they are, how high they are. Because you can shine a light up there, but there's just not, you can't see no ceiling or nothing. And it's really strange sometimes when you look at it.
Let's ask a little bit about what you can see underground. You have a light on your helmet, and is there other electric wiring underground, or is the only light you have what's on your hat?
We have electric lights on our helmet, and we carry about a battery that maybe weighs about 2 pounds, and it's good for a good 8 hours or more, but we got the lights in the drifts, and they're just like electric lights that we have at home, and the main lines are all lit up,
Is there a separate electrical crew that would string electric power and put the lights in?
And we have electric crew on there all the time. They come and do all the wiring, and then they got all electric boxes there, into the contracts. And they're pretty heavy loaded. I don't know how much voltage it is, but it's pretty high because it runs them 3,000 horsepower motor, 1,000 horsepower motors in the bigger contracts where they got to pull long drifts. And they're all electric, and it's pretty powerful, and it's all lit up.
How long did you work at the Mather B, Louis, and how old were you when you retired, and what year was that?
When I retired? When I retired, or? And when I took my pension, it was I got hurt in the mine, so I hurt my knee and I couldn't work anymore. So, that was in 75. And I think, 55, I think it was. That went on there.
You mentioned that you hurt your knee and that was the reason why you were you stopped working at the Mather Bee. Could you tell me how that happened?
And how I hurt my knee, I was carrying me and my partner was carrying what they call the bumblebee. That was a drilling machine that weighed about 300 pounds. And then there were screens over the hoppers, and it looked good all the time. We walked over several times, and when I stepped on it this one time, carrying the machine, I went right through the hopper and hurt my knee post-spav, and I was 1 year off and work, and hurt my back and my knee. And
at the time that happened, can you describe how they got you out of the mine, and that, do you remember how that chain of events went after you fell?
After I fell, then they took me up and then I went for treatments, for many treatments, but then I thought I could make it again, but I went back to work, and Dr. Williams says, I told him, I said, I can't work this way. I says, it hurts way up in my back, you know, and I says, I don't like to be my partner, I says, and can't do my own job, you know. And he says, if you can't work no more, he says, take early retirement, I suppose. And so they were, and then I took it, you know, when they left me. And I think that was I think I got my full pension and everything. I think that was, I got out there, I didn't work anymore. I think it was 59, I think, was when I took it all. Yeah.
Can we think for a minute about you've mentioned a lot of words like the bumblebee, and can you think of any other nicknames that the miners had for any of the equipment or for different guys who had different kinds of jobs? I mean, their formal job description might have been miner, but was there a nickname for what they did? Any of those kinds of things that you can think of?
Then the earlier years, I worked at the Mather A, I worked in the Rock Drift there. That was on three shifts. And we'd drill and blast. We were driving drifts then, and into rock, mostly rock, and two shifts. And we'd use Conways to load, what they call Conways. They were big air machines with big dippers on the front, and there was a conveyor on there with a belt, and that would load into a car, and then you haul it away when the car was loaded, and until we got all cleaned up, ready to drill again. And that was part of a job we done for 2 years, about 2 years, and I went at the time, and that was kind of interesting too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Conway was one thing. Was there any, did you have any, I know somebody told me that when they would get ready to blast, they would say fire in the hole, and that's how the other guys would know that they had to stay put. Can you think of any other little things like that? Were there any sayings that only the miners would understand, only the people underground would understand?
And when they blasted, you'd have to tell, go and tell your contractor was close by, and then you had to watch that you were going to blast, and that was the rules. and you'd have to watch all the openings that come in from any way at all, for nobody would come happen to come in and walk into it. So you'd have to watch all that and before you blast, mm-hmm. and to make it safety.
Let me stop for a second here. Do you remember what it smelled like underground? Was there, after all this blasting would happen, was there a sulfur smell or anything like that? Or was there any particular odors that you remember noticing underground all the time?
And when they blasted, if you went in too fast into a blast, after blasting, it'd be kind of powder smell, and then you'd have to wet down, take the hose and wet down. You had water there all the time, and you'd have to wet down the pile, your dirt piles, to kill the gas down and knock all that down. And then after the gas was gone, and then you turn air or some compressed air in there would blow that all out of there. And then they had fans, most contracts that would blow in there, and most of the contracts and it would blow all that gas out. Then you go ahead and load all, scrape all your dirt or load it whatever way you were drifting, and
now, during the time that you worked in the mines, was that considered to be one of the best jobs that there was around, and if so, why?
The mine industry was I put everybody I talked to was supporting. There were a big thing in Marquette, Negaunee, Ishming, and around 100 miles or more around, and for business. And then the college wasn't there. We didn't have the air base, and the mine was pretty supported in this part of the country, and several mines, and mostly were the Cliff, and. And there was a lot of other mines that too, but the Cleveland Cliff was seemed to be the one that's operating the still operating, and they were pretty big in Marquette, the Ellisoni Docks and the Ellisoni Railroad, and pretty supporting.
Well, can you tell me if there are any particular experiences that kind of stand out in your mind that the people would be surprised to hear about that you had to do underground?
There was some of the drifts when I was first started, when I were on the Heisen Timber, you know, me and my partner, and them drifts was, there was some drifts that weren't working no more, and there them. Where all wooden timbers was, that was mostly the Negaunee mine. And them contracts, we'd have to go over to one contract or the other, and some of them old drifts was coming down, and gradually, but not fast or nothing. But there was always a hole was big enough, you know, you could crawl on either timber just to fit your body. We'd take shortcuts and go underneath that, and of course everybody did, you know, and we always think, well, what if it comes down the line and crowd you in there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But we'd go through there fast, we'd run through there fast, and so them timbers were pretty heavy and broken. And, but there was just your body could go through.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We used to climb from the level, the main levels, up in those contracts. there was some between the contracts where they were way up there. It was almost 300 feet climbing the ladder or straight up, and then they had gates in there that dropped down every, I don't know, about every 30, 40 feet, and for safety. But the ladders are right straight up, and you never look down. You just keep on going up, but 200 to 300 feet straight up, and all you'd see is a little light down there, you know, where the level was. And when we flew on the level, Heisen Timber, and we talked to our partners in the contracts, and there was a pipe. All you had is a pipe to talk into, and it would echo, and it was really loud, you know, when you're talking that pipe, you know, and it just like carry right through. It was interesting.
Wow. Never heard that story before.
When I went into the mines, you know, and when I first went in, then they put me with some of those people that come from Europe, and they were Italians, they were Finnish people, and English, and we start talking, you know, and the Italian people, I didn't understand them at all. They were there from the 1800s, I think, and they were just about ready to take their pension when I started, and they had their boys working with them, and the only way I could understand them, you know, is they talked their own nationalities, but the boys would talk in English. And I learned Italian, some Italian. I learned some Finnish that way, and Swedish, Norwegian, and a lot of words. And being that the kid, the boys would talk to them in English, and that's the way I learned it. But the older people was talking, you know, their own nationality all the time. So I got to learn quite a bit.
Yeah. Do you have any idea, during that time when there were people that spoke different languages in the mine, like, was it about half of the people who spoke foreign languages, or was it maybe a third? Any guess on what proportion it was?
I don't know the percentage, really, but the most of them.
Most of them?
I would say the most of them.
Wow.
Yeah. The most of them spoke their own nationality, and carried on that way, so, but you get used to it.
Yeah. Did you find that with the people of the various backgrounds, did the people who spoke Italian pretty much stick together? Did the people who spoke Finnish stick together? Or did they all mix together and try to learn how to communicate with each other?
Most of the nationalities was those days stuck quite a bit together, and Finnish and Italians was quite a bit together, to my knowledge, the majority of the other ones was more they talk more, you could talk to them more.
Do you recall whether a lot of the people who spoke the same languages were assigned together on work crews, or do you remember if they were kind of split apart?
Most of the nationalities were put together with their own. I would say Finnish was Finnish, and Italians was quite a bit Italian, mm-hmm. And then the later years, They were mixed up more. Then they got mixed up more. Yeah.
Do you recall whether there were any divisions of kinds of jobs? Did the Italians do certain kinds of jobs? Did the Finns do certain kinds of jobs? Or were they? Did it make any difference?
Well, some of them had quite a bit of their own jobs. There was electricians, pipemen, and guys that fix cars. We were the car zoner and maintenance crew, and there was carpenters that fix gates and all that stuff. And they had mostly all different kinds of jobs, electricians and everything. Yeah,
but there wasn't any kind of common knowledge that maybe, like, for instance, the Italians always did dynamite and the Finns always did electricity or anything like that. It was pretty much dependent upon what the person's skill was.
It was all what their jobs was and their skill was, and lots of them liked what they were doing, and they stuck to it. And miner was a miner, and the other jobs, they all loved their jobs, and they put in their whole career that way, I think, as far as I know.